Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another interview on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing Dr. Paolo Squatriti about his book titled Weeds and the Carolingians, Empire, Culture, and Nature in Frankish Europe, AD 750 to 900, which has come out from Cambridge University Press. In the book really asks why weeds mattered in the Carolingian Empire. I admit, full honesty, this is not something I had ever thought about until I saw the title of this book, and then immediately became fascinated, read the blurb, and then decided I needed to read the whole thing. This was absolutely so many things opened up in my brain from this. So I'm really excited to discuss it on the podcast, because I think that that will be true for a lot of our listeners as well. So Paolo, thank you so much for coming and joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Could we start off, please, with a bit of an introduction from yourself and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Well, I'm a professor of early medieval European history, and I teach at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan, United States. And there is a burgeoning field of early medieval European history, despite it's apparent
my obscurity. unfamiliarity
yes.
with it.
Yes, and there are, especially in England, actually, it's a burgeoning field, but also throughout Europe, and Australia is another lively place for those studies. And I've been active in that field for a long time now, several decades. And from the beginning of my sort of publication career, I have been interested in environmental sorts of issues, the questions about how people fit into and adapt to the environments in which they, the natural environments in which they live. And this book is a continuation of my explorations of early medieval European history from an environmental perspective. The question about exactly how I got to this topic, it's an outgrowth of a previous research project that I had. I studied the dissemination throughout Europe, I guess mostly in Italy, but there is a section about the rest of Europe, of a particular species of tree, namely the sweet chestnut, and argued that it was an early medieval invention, that in the ancient world, chestnuts were not cultivated and were therefore very, very scarce. And that instead in the early Middle Ages, this plant, which in ancient literature, Greek and Roman, is very much disparaged and obscure, became instead an important presence in the woodlands. Anyway, that set up the question of how societies evaluate plants, how they decide that this is a good plant or a bad plant, and obviously the scale of a chestnut tree, which can be truly magnificent in some cases, is not the same as the scale of the smaller, generally annual plants that I covered in this other book, but it's sort of the same issue, the issue of how we as people decide that certain plants are worthy and other ones aren't. And that's, I think, the short answer to the question about how I got to it.
That makes a lot of sense, and kind of goes very nicely into the very first kind of big question in the book, which is that you argue that for the Carolingians, weeds were, I mean, we might think of them as being physically uncontrollable, but you argue that that was probably also true, but that weeds were, quote, intellectually uncontrollable. Why?
Yes, it's, I think you're right, that there is a connection with what I was talking about before. Fundamentally, I think it's not just the Carolingians, but all humans are certainly the ones that I know a little bit about, the European ones, are always worried about order, about how nature conforms or doesn't conform to their sense of tidiness and intellectual comprehensibility and order in the end. So I think that for the Carolingians, the issue of the intellectual ability to figure out why and how there were these plants that seemed to be operating actively against their economic interests and their that became a political and also a theological issue. It came down to how come, I guess, there was evil in the world in a certain sense. Why did the beneficent God, whose agent the Carolingians claimed to be, permit these pestiferous vegetable creatures to get in their way so much? And why was it that God's good creation was inhabited not just by good creatures, but by these very difficult to eradicate and often quite damaging plants? So I think that the Carolingian phase of the early medieval period is one in which there are a lot more texts than there had been, say, in the 7th or even early 8th century. And so it gives me a chance to see European early medieval society generating writing on an issue that I presume had exercised their predecessors, but whose texts haven't survived or were never created. And the Carolingian texts, I would say, articulate this ongoing human worry about, does it all make sense? Does nature actually conform to the rules that I think it should? In the Carolingian world, the rule was that God had created it and that God was good and God was on our side. And so then the question emerges, well, then what are all these weeds doing in our fields and in our gardens? How come this bad thing is going on? How come these bad plants seem to prevail? So I think there was an anxiety in Carolingian intellectual culture that derived from a, you know, broader moral, philosophical, and theological issue about the presence of bad things in the good world.
What does it mean to, you know, have we done something wrong that this is happening, or is maybe God not as powerful as we thought? You raise all sorts of kind of very anxiety-provoking questions that it sounds like they were wrestling with. And so I wanted to kind of ask about that, because one of the parts of the debate that they seem to have had a lot is, maybe obsession is a bit too far, but really quite a strong focus on trying to figure out when weeds were created. Why was this such a big deal in sort of the debates around the role and place of weeds?
A lot of the sources that I looked at, where I found the richest veins of information on how Carolingian people conceived of bad plants, was exegesis or commentary on the Judeo-Christian story of creation, in other words, on Genesis, the first book of the Christian and Hebrew scriptures. And in Genesis, you know, it's actually a bit of a hodgepodge of different versions of how the world came to be. But as you read, if you were to read the text as a single narrative, it emerges that when God had created the plants, he pronounced that they were good, that he liked what he saw. And since, you know, there were these plants that, as far as the average Carolingian looking out of his window could tell, were not good, then that sort of raised the question of where perhaps after that God had finished making this perfect world in the, you know, 6 days, and the seventh day he rested, perhaps he had an afterthought, and as I say in the book, like a bad architect, he went back to the blueprint and injected in some retrofitted some weeds, because otherwise he wouldn't have said that they were all good. And that was a disturbing thought to Carolingian theologians, who didn't like its implications about the imperfection of God's plan. You know, God had to correct his original work. It's not the way an omnipotent God actually should be behaving. So the Carolingian exegetes, commentators on Genesis, didn't like the idea of a kind of second creation of God at some point deciding that he had to go back and correct and amend what he had already created. The likeliest time for that amendment, of course, would have been when God got angry with the humans and expelled them from Eden, from the perfect garden where they had originally been set up to live. And then weeds might be imagined to have been a kind of a punishment that God inflicted on humans expelled out into the ordinary world where we all find ourselves. But Carolingians didn't like that idea, as I said, because it made God seem a little inconstant, let's say. And so they followed the theories that had been articulated in late antiquity in the very beginning of the 5th century by the greatest Latin theologian of the first millennium, Augustine of Hippo, the North African church father, who had proved to everybody's who could read him satisfaction that in fact all the plants had been created at the beginning on that third day. And it was just because of our human greed, ultimately, our need to make a living, to our desire to accumulate resources, that certain plants, which were actually put on earth for excellent ecological reasons by God, looked to us as farmers, basically, or as herders, to be bad, to be weeds. And so Augustine's explanation of the presence of bad plants on earth is enthusiastically adopted by the vast majority of Carolingian commentators, who agreed with him that all the plants, including the weeds, were created by God at the beginning. And although we don't perceive them to be good, even the worst weed is in a certain sense good, because it is performing some function which we may not understand in sustaining the ecosystem, or at least that's the term that we would use, but in making a habitat for birds or for insects that we don't perceive as useful. But obviously, if you're a bird or an insect, you would find very useful. And so I guess that what's interesting about this, to me, about this exegesis, is that it's willing to see the world from a slightly less anthropocentric point of view, and to allow that it's only from an anthropocentric point of view that certain plants seem bad. And it's only from that same anthropocentric that wheat would seem particularly good. And I think that's where the Carolingian anxieties or troubles and their answers to those anxieties and troubles come out of. It's part of a longer discourse, a longer conversation in Christian theology about the creation act of God, and whether it was completed on the sixth day, or whether it had some amendments and some buttressing needed later on after God discovered some things that he hadn't thought of earlier.
Thank you for explaining that and kind of how it fits into the wider debates and anxieties. But I want to sort of poke at one of the points, the idea of sort of, well, all of these plants, they might seem troublesome to us, but maybe they have some uses that we don't fully understand. And in fact, you talk about in the book how the vocabulary used by these writers around weeds in a lot of ways reflects this idea of kind of multiple uses and perspectives for these plants. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about kind of what the actual language is telling us about these debates.
Yes. The Carolingian language, as I think you're alluding to, is in a certain way less precise than English, the modern English, which has this word weed, which is unusual, as far as I can tell, in modern languages, many other modern European languages, anyway, the ones that I know, don't have such a word. In other words, a special word that says that the plant is bad and lumps lots of different kinds of plants under that category. Instead, in say, the Romance languages, you would use the same word for plant and say bad plant. So you would modify the word that also qualifies some vegetation as good. The same word gets used. So the Carolingians didn't have a word for weed. What they did was qualify the word for plant as bad or good. That's how they talked about it. And my study of the subject suggested that there were certain characteristics in plants that led to them being considered bad. And most interesting of all was that the characteristic that's most important is that they get mentioned in the scriptures. In other words, if in the scriptures plants, a plant is named as a particularly wicked plant, even if the Carolingians lived in a completely different ecology and were probably unfamiliar with that plant, they didn't live in an arid climate in Palestine, they considered that plant very bad. And so since in Palestine, when the scriptures were being assembled in the first millennium BC, a good defense against browsing, for example, by goats and sheep would be to be very prickly. There's a lot of prickly plants in that area, and they were detrimental to the interests of the humans who live there. So in the scriptures, prickliness is a characteristic of weediness. It's one of the things that makes you almost certainly a weed. And that's one of the words that gets used in the Carolingian text to qualify a bad plant. It's that it's prickly. That's one of the characteristics. It's just an example. But it tends to be that the words used by the Carolingians are words that have been used in the scriptures to qualify bad plants. And the characteristics that they describe tend to be characteristics that had been denigrated or looked upon with suspicion a couple of millennia earlier in a completely different ecological context.
You highlight, in fact, that there are some instances where it wasn't necessarily clear whether these plants were even things that Carolingians would have actually experienced themselves. They may not have known what they looked like, and that was a whole kind of area of confusion, and all sorts of debates were had on that, which I found really interesting.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, the particularly curious is that there are these a category of book that is mostly used by medical practitioners in the early Middle Ages, which are basically lists of plants which can be used, and then their medical properties are qualified. And there's a particularly interesting one that seems to be fairly pragmatic. It seems to come out of the Alpine region, somewhere in Switzerland maybe, and to include plants which are not part of the classical medical lore. So you'd say, finally they're being practical. They're actually looking outside of their own windows and seeing that there is this plant that the ancient Mediterranean peoples didn't know about that has some medical purpose. So you say, how practical of them. And in that very same manuscript, there are all kinds of plants that have never grown anywhere near Central Europe or the Alpine, and of which the medical practitioner would have no experience and wouldn't have access to, but they're listed together. That's a fascinating juxtaposition of the immediate, the real, the practical, and the, you know, perfectly literary and derivative and impractical.
So I'd love to move to the practical for a moment, because one of the things that you look at in the book is not just the debates within the theological community around kind of what is the role of God and what do weeds tell us about the universe, but you also look at practically what weeds were showing up for actual farmers in that time period, and then very helpfully compare those two things. And we're probably going to discuss that the results really don't go together. But now that we have some sense of kind of what the educated class, the literary class, I suppose, were debating, can you tell us about practically on the ground, what were some of the things that were happening, that were changing around Carolingian farming practices that influenced or impacted weeds and vice versa?
Yes. One of the strokes of luck that I've had in my brilliant career has been the unexpected growth of the science of archaeobotany, which is the extraction of botanical information from archaeological contexts. And 25 years ago, it was virtually unknown or extremely little practice. But nowadays, it's a regular practice of archaeologists excavating rural or urban sites to try, at least, to preserve seeds, traces of pollens, bits of plant that have inevitably ended up in the site and whose size would earlier have excluded them from archaeological consideration. But now with sieving and all kinds of extremely elaborate laboratory analyses, you can have a very complete picture of what plants were most closely implicated with sites where humans settled. Which has given us access to ordinary people and their interactions with plants, which is obviously not the same in the Carolingian period in the 8th and 9th century, with what the learned and the privileged and the elite interaction with plants might have been. There are obviously some overlaps, but it's quite different when you excavate a peasant house somewhere in northern France and get the botanical, archaeobotanical information, it opens a completely new vision of what's actually it's possible to know about. And I tried in this book to include the archaeobotany, which has built up in the last couple of decades, into a respectable corpus of information. The problem is that it's endlessly developing. It's a burgeoning field, so it's very difficult to actually keep track of everything that's being excavated and published on the plants that grew in the 8th and 9th century in the Carolingian world. Very difficult to do that. And then also that each site is kind of a story of its own, because it's the plants and that grew around there are very much influenced by microecological factors. And so it's hard then to weave all of these microecologies into some kind of coherent narrative. However, I tried to do something synthetic and to look at as many as I could find out about sites and their archaeobotanical discoveries. And the long and the short of it was that most of the celebrity weeds that end up in the texts of the learned are not the weeds that if you had been living in a early medieval village in the Carolingian world would have been of great concern to you. And in particular, you know, the sort of poster child of this whole narrative that I'm giving you is the story of Darnel, as it's known in English, of a mimic weed, a weed which is particularly similar to a wheat and grows at the same time with the same rhythms and resembles it very, very closely. and which is a celebrity weed in the Carolingian period because Jesus actually mentions it. And so, you know, since Jesus's words don't crop up that often in the Gospels, if Jesus is recorded telling a story about darnel, that gives darnel very great importance to Christian readers in the early Middle Ages. So the texts are full, the learned texts are full of reports of terrible things that darnel is up to. And darnel is instead almost never found. There's a few sites, two or three, where in minimal quantities, it seems that darnel actually may have been in someone's grain field. So I guess that the story that I highlighted was the contrast between the weeds of the learned and the weeds that were most probably in the fields of the period and the place of the Carolingian European landscape.
So why was there such a big contrast?
I'm not sure.
It seems somewhat odd.
It seems odd, yeah. Oh, of course, we also have, we give much more prominence to certain plants that aren't in the end very familiar to us. The plants exist both in the imagination and in the ground, right? So there's in any society, there are certain plants that have disproportionate cultural importance to their actual commonness. But I think that one problem is that the authors of the early Middle Ages in general, and the Carolingian ones for sure, were talking to each other, were talking to other learned people, and their texts circulated within a fairly rarefied world of texts. And that's really the intended audience, other readers who have the same conventions, the same education, the same expectations as the writer. So it's a kind of a closed circuit. And they don't perceive necessarily the utility of injecting into this closed circuit observations from their direct lived experience. It happens occasionally, but it's not the point of the exercise, really. So the first possibility is that literary sources in the early Middle Ages are not directly concerned with empirical reality. They're a different thing, right? So that would be one possibility. The other one, of course, is that the archaeobotany is incomplete, and that although we have many dozens of sites excavated, they don't represent what was actually going on. It's also possible that the textual sources are perfectly accurate about what should have been worrying any good Frankish farmer in the 8th and 9th century. I tried to navigate a middle ground between these two interpretations to suggest that, yes, it's possible that darnel, for example, or some of the other celebrity weeds were more prominent than we actually know, and more dangerous and more worrisome. And I also suggested that the Carolingian writers were not completely removed from reality, in that they recognized the limitations of humans' ability to deal with, handle, and control vegetable reality, and that in a sense they were empirical in recognizing the agency and the power of plants out there, and so that even their rarefied intellectual discourse was pertinent, was relevant, was in a certain way also based on empirical understandings of how nature works.
Many possibilities there. But to make it even more complicated, I want to expand out the conversation, because so far we've talked about the sort of rarefied writers who are in many cases primarily theologians or involved in religious life in some way. And then the farmers actually in the fields going, these are annoying plants, why are they here? And those two things don't match. But you also talk about sort of a third realm, I suppose, related to this, which of course is politics. So can you explain to us, there were many aspects that we'd seem to come up in political discussions, but to start off with, I'm wondering if you can help us understand why weeds were a political question when it comes to the calendar and time.
One of the things that perhaps I should remind anybody who happens to be listening about is that when an academic book gets written, it's usually 4 or 5 years before it appears in print, and therefore you can be interviewed about. So I'm not completely sure that I'm able to remember exactly the calendrical chapter there, but I'll make a stab as the author at recollecting authoritatively what it was I had to say about time and the passage of time and when weeds crop up. But since the Carolingians were anxious about the proper disposition of time and organizing time properly in a Christian worldview, Charlemagne especially, but also his successors, were concerned about making a uniform calendar for the entire empire, which they constructed laboriously in the late 8th century and then ruled for another few decades into the late 9th century. They wanted everybody to be doing pretty much the same things at the same time, so especially worshiping God at the same time. And so there's a calendrical reform in which they invest a fair amount of energy, at least around the year 800, a fair amount of energy was invested. And it's not a complete failure because some of the Carolingian calendrical choices are still reflected in the modern calendar that most of the world goes by today. So it's not a completely ineffectual choice, but Charlemagne seems to have not liked the names of the months that were most commonly in circulation, especially in the Germanic language speaking parts of his empire, and to try to update them. And in that whole debate about what the right names to give to months ought to be, it turns out that there was this, there was the possibility, it seems to be, that some people considered the month of August to be the month of the weeds, of the weed month. And Charlemagne didn't like this, and he stamped it out or tried to stamp it out. And so from my point of view, what was interesting was that it was possible to imagine that weeds are concentrated in one month, and especially in a month that in most parts of Europe, I'm not sure that weeding would have been a high priority in that month, it being past the harvest in almost all parts of Europe, and maybe that in some remote parts of very cold Europe, they still hadn't harvested in August. But by the time that's the month, by the time it's August, most places weeding is not a high priority, I would say. So again, it's an example of how the written discourse, the written text, seems to not reflect very precisely the agrarian reality, but still it also is a reflection of the desire of the governing authorities, of the politicians, of the rulers, to impose a standardized and tidy and orthodox reckoning and measurement of time and naming of the various subdivisions of time. It's all part of the same story. I got involved in it mostly because of the fact that there is this odd assignment of one twelfth of the year to the weeds. And so I speculated a bit as to why that might have been. And that's how I got involved in the calendrical issue. I did also try to make the observation that although the standard, you know, modern definition of weeds is plants out of place, I suggested that actually weeds are also plants at the wrong time, because, you know, if a plant that I don't like grows in my field when the field is dormant. It's not quite as weedy as when, if that very same species of plant were to spring up in my field at the very moment when I have crops in there. So its weediness is actually a function not just of it growing in that field, but it growing in that field at a specific moment. So there's a time component to weediness, and that's also part of the story that I tried to tell.
Yeah, thank you for explaining both of those aspects. As I said, a number of ways in which sort of political questions and how things are organized comes into play. And I'd love to ask about one further, which is how Charlemagne was described in accounts at the time, among his many accolades. You note that he was also described as being a skilled weeder. Why was that an accolade that was considered worth including in the list?
That's a good question. We should all be good weeders, right? It's the ability to discern and to separate the good from the bad is obviously something that any politician wants to claim to be good at. And I'm not convinced that it's just Charlemagne. I briefly mentioned in the book, because I was teaching an environmental history class when about 4 years ago, the president of France came to visit the president of the United States. And they were photographed together with their high-heeled respective wives and the front lawn of the White House, armed with shovels, planting a seedling of an oak tree, a tiny little oak tree, which then it turned out withered and died. But that wasn't part of what ended up on the front pages of the newspapers. The pictures and the story in the newspaper was this great moment of friendship between the president of France and the president of the United States, Macron and Trump, and the fact that they were manfully planting a little oak tree on the front lawn of the White House. So politics and plants and planting and the ability of great leaders to manipulate and make stuff grow appropriately, I'd say it's not just the Carolingian, it's not just an attribute of Charlemagne. We still like our leaders to be in control of the vegetable world. This particular seedling, it turned out, was from some forest in some place where large numbers of American GIs were killed in the First World War. And so it had a symbolic meaning, but still that meaning, I think, was subordinated to the fact of the two men with shovels planting a specific kind of plant in a specific place. That's all the ruler as manipulator of the vegetable world. And I think that's what the propaganda value to Charlemagne as being the weeder in chief of the Carolingian Empire was, that he was carrying out the separation of the good from the bad plants and taking care of his realm in a way, in this rhetoric, because I'm not sure that Charlemagne ever weeded anything, but in the texts, when he is represented that way, that's the point. It's the point that he is the man who reestablishes Edenic harmonies and Edenic perfect relations between plants and people through his interventions separation, which are all based, of course, on a very acute and insightful discernment, an ability to identify this is the good one, that one is the bad one, and therefore they must be separated. That's, I think, the ultimate political compliment that you can pay to Charlemagne by calling him an excellent weeder. And that, I think, if I recall correctly what you're referring to, that particular piece of propaganda also suggests that he was doing his weeding with a sword.
Yes, I believe so, which is an interesting methodology to weed.
I've never done it, but yeah, it's probably not easy. It takes special skill to do your weeding with a sword. But obviously there's a martial component to that story, how he's depicted. He's not just the leader in chief, but he's also a great military leader. And that same piece of propaganda, which is actually not Carolingian's, it's a little later, but the poem that where that appears, that the song where that appears, also goes on and on about how he laid low vast armies of people using a sword. So the weed and the human enemy are kind of assimilated there.
So that kind of confirms the idea that there are good plants and bad plants. And as you said, the discernment is figuring out which is which. And in a lot of ways, the kind of the fact of the sword being the implement sort of suggests that kind of once you're bad, that's the end of it. Redemption does not happen. Like, it is a fatal thing to be bad. But you also show in the book that throughout these debates, particularly in the educated writing class, there's, as we spoke about already, kind of some amount of ambivalence or mixed different understandings about weeds, and maybe it's human ignorance to not fully understand God's purpose with some of these plants, etc. But you also talk about in the book that there are, in these debates, ways for weeds to become good, to rise above their status. Can you maybe tell us about kind of what that process looked like to these writers and why they were discussing it?
Yes. I think that in a way, the weediness being a matter of place and time, if the bad plant happens to grow in the right place and at the right time, it can sort of rehabilitate itself. It can become acceptable. So in the learned discourse, there is, in the very same books that sometimes condemn a plant as a wicked, wicked plant because it has some scriptural association that are bad, you can then find sometimes bound together in the same manuscript a herbal that would be a text about the medical properties of plants, which extols the curative properties of the very same plant. So there it's a matter, well, in the scripture, if Jesus said that it's a bad plant, obviously it's a very, very bad plant. However, we've also noticed that if you gather it in the woods at the right time of the year, this plant cures you of X. And so there's a kind of a medical rehabilitation of plants that can happen. And then in the early Middle Ages, there's also a kind of an ascetical rehabilitation. I mentioned earlier that early medieval people found prickly plants particularly distressing. That's the worst kind of weed is darnel, but second is any kind of prickly plant. And instead, there are lots of ascetics who use the prickly plant to mortify the flesh and find that it actually improves their closeness to God. It makes it easier for them to commune with the divine. And so the prickly plant can have a kind of a spiritual betterment effect. So medical, ascetical literature uses plants which normally would be considered terrible in most contexts, uses them at just the right time and just the right place to produce good effects. And in those cases, the plant rises through the ranks and becomes perfectly acceptable. There's a couple of examples of how, I guess there's a kind of mobility on the scale that vegetable life has. It can go up and down in our estimation. And early medieval people were aware of that, even though they were perfectly terrified by darnel and all the bad things that it could do to you, as Jesus had spelled out. They also understood that darnel in certain circumstances might have some improving effects on us. And so it's really a matter of, as you said, discernment, but also a matter of time and place. It's how and when and where you use the plant that determines whether it's going to be a bad one or a good one.
That makes sense. That is, as you already said, a much more nuanced position on weeds than perhaps we have either in English or today, walking out into a garden going, why? But clearly these debates yielded rather a lot of discussion that evolved and developed as it went on, rather than just repeating itself for centuries. So that's really interesting and helpful for having you explain. So thank you very much for that. Being cognizant of time and also of things evolving, I'm wondering, as our final question for this interview, if you would maybe be able to share with us, now that this book is published, what you might be working on now or next.
We're one of the, since the 80s, probably, academics are not allowed to say, "I'm not doing anything, I'm just dead wood." We're always supposed to be on to the next. But I am. I think right now I've got a small project that I'm working on. My next big one is going to be about Rome, which is my hometown, and its river. I'd like to write about how, during the early Middle Ages, the relationship between the city and the Tiber changed compared to earlier or even later. Fundamentally, the argument would be, it's a bad sign that I haven't done the research and I already have my argument, but the argument is going to be that the course of the Tiber, the flow of it basically from north to south, was reversed in the early Middle Ages in a certain sense, and that the importation of foods into the metropolis that had been the main function of the Tiber in the Roman period stopped. And instead, food was no longer being moved from the sea to Rome upstream, south to north. But instead, what did go into Rome was with the flow of the river and came from a much smaller geographical basin, let's say, from a much more localized. So that would be the larger project. But right now, I actually am working on something related to the weeds. I've become interested in the composition of the Eucharist. In other words, of the piece of bread which Christians still today, and certainly in the early Middle Ages, used in the commemorative ritual central to their practices on Sundays, right? And I've noticed that in the period between roughly 400 and roughly 1000, in other words, during the early Middle Ages, the recipe for making this special bread changes radically. And I've started wondering how come that was the case. In other words, at the very beginning of the period, people could make the Eucharist out of any old flour. It didn't matter. It didn't have to be particularly finely sieved. It didn't matter what color the flour was. It could be slightly gray, slightly yellow. It could be made out of barley. It could be made out of all kinds of different grains. And then, actually, in the Carolingian period, in the 9th century, people start getting increasingly strict about how you make this concoction, how you make this bread, and they become much more worried about it being very, very pure flour and being exclusively wheat. In other words, the body of God will not be present if you have even a single grain of barley ground in there by mistake. And this big transformation, this shift towards a much more finely sifted, much more white, much more lightly baked, much more wheaten Eucharist, I'm trying to understand the relation between the new recipes that start to emerge and ecology. I'm trying to figure out if it has something going on in climate history, if there's something going on in agricultural history that would explain why Christians suddenly couldn't find God except in a very, very finely sifted, pure wheaten Eucharists. That's my current interest.
Well, both of those projects sound absolutely fascinating. So thank you for giving us sort of a sneak peek, as it were, into them. I think there will be a lot of people, certainly myself included, who will be interested to see what happens with that. But while you are off investigating wheat and what goes into the Eucharist, as well as Rome and its river, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing, which again is titled Weed and the Carolingians, Empire, Culture and Nature in Frankish Europe from Cambridge University Press. Dr. Paolo Squatriti, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much. And it is not weed in the Carolingians, but weeds. It's an important distinction.
An important distinction. Very well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.